Welcome to the Sports Bro Podcast with Sports Bro Editorial Director James Emmett, getting right inside the sports industry and then recording it on audio.
Yes, indeed. Welcome to another Sports Pro podcast with me, James Emmett, on location here in the Olympic city of Lausanne for 2016's Sport Accord Convention. With me, blast from the past, David Cushnan, Global Communications Manager from Repcom. Hello, David.
Hello, James.
Blaster from the pastor, it's Patrick Nally. You could be a pastor, actually, Patrick.
That's not fair, but hello, hello, James. Yeah.
Chaps, very simple question to go on with. We're sitting here at the end of day two of Sport Accord. What have we learned so far? What have you two learned so far? Anything interesting here? Obviously, last year we had an explosive session from Marius Fiza. Nothing of the sort this year. It's more of a sort of conciliatory tone, I suppose. What have we learned?
Well, you're right. It's calm. Mm. Is it too calm? Eerily calm. I think everybody's on best behaviour, I suspect, at the moment. I mean, we're just talking a few minutes before the opening ceremony where, I mean, I can't imagine.
Weirdly, 2 days in the opening ceremony.
I know, that is strange, isn't it? I'm not sure why that is, but can't imagine we're going to have the same sort of incendiary comments as we had last year at around this point in the convention. It does feel as though, as you say, we're waiting for the General Assembly of Sport Accord, which I believe is on Friday, where a new president will be elected, and only then we will see, what is to become of the organisation and the whole culture around it. I suppose I saw earlier on here on the top level of the exhibition floor a very very lonely looking Marius Fiza, who was wandering around idly texting or looking at something on his phone, and I did think, what a difference a year makes. He was not being hassled. He was not in any way the centre of attention. He looked a little bit forlorn, but he's obviously here in his role as International Judo Federation. But 12 months is a long time in sports politics.
Indeed. A lot of people sort of questioning where Sport Accord's going in terms of its relevance to the Olympic movement, sports movement as a whole. Patrick, this is quite a momentous Sport Accord for you, I understand, in your role as President of the International Poker Federation, because I believe, am I right in saying that you've just got membership to Sport Accord?
Not yet. I have to wait till Friday. But if the vote goes according to plan, then yes, I will become a member of Sport Accord or IFP. Match Poker will be the first e-sport that will be accepted by Sport Accord. But you're right, this is also my 40th anniversary, because 40 years ago I spoke at the first GAFE Congress when we created GAFE with a central headquarters and a headquarters in Monte Carlo as a sort of talking shop, as a gathering of all international federations. And of course, they are going through this sort of big problem at this present moment, is do they have a role? Do all international federations, to whether they're Olympic or non-Olympic, have a role? Does the conference and the Congress merge, where they've got two very different constitutions? The Congress is really made up of the members predominantly of Olympic, where the Congress is made up of more non-Olympic than Olympic. So I think everybody's being very calm and quiet because they don't want to create another war. They don't want to fall out with the IOC. But I think everybody also wants to come up with something that is going to work. They do want to collaborate. And the feeling I get is everybody wants it to survive. But how it will survive is the big question.
Probably a good point in the podcast for me to introduce a discussion I had a little bit earlier with respected Olympic journalist Duncan Mackay from Inside the Games, where we talked about Sport Accord, what it could look like in the future, and he gave his views on a couple of notable figures within the sports industry, and pretty hard-hitting they were too. So here's Duncan Mackay. Duncan Mackay, Big Chief at Inside the Games. We're here yet again at Sport Accord, another Sport Accord. First of all, before we talk about what Sport Accord is, Duncan, how many of them have you been to?
I was working this out earlier. I've been to everyone since 2005, which was in Berlin. And the reason I went to that one in 2005 was because we were coming to the end of the bid process for 2012, and all the cities that were bidding, there were four of them, they were all allowed to have a stand in those days. And I remember turning up and the London 2012 stand was next to Moscow's 2012 stand. And we turned up and they had half a dozen leggy Russian blondes there handing out vodka. And I remember Seb Coe and Keith Mills, who were the head of the London bid at the time, they were giggling like naughty schoolboys. One of the other officials from London 2012 turned up and was outraged that Moscow had broken the rules by having these women on their stand. And
No women allowed in Olympic bidding processes, of course.
Well, especially not leggy Russian blondes handing out free vodka. Yeah. So they were removed, much to the disappointment of, I think, everybody at Sport Accord that year.
Yeah.
So that's my first one.
Indeed. And, of course, it's evolved in terms of what it is, what it means. Basic run-through of what it is now. It's two organisations, really, both of them called Sport Accord. Sport Accord, which is effectively a union of international sports federations and other federations, and the Sport Accord Convention, which is the conference where they all meet and other people come and try to do business with them and do business with each other, and people like you and me come along and sniff for stories. What have you sniffed this year?
It's early days yet. We've had one of the things that happens at the Sport Accord Convention is all the various bodies that you've mentioned hold their annual general meeting. So we've had the Association of Olympic International Federations, its winter equivalent. We've had the Olympic recognised non-Olympic sports, which always sounds strange to me, makes me laugh. So we've picked up bits and pieces there. We've got some nice financial juicy things to come out, hopefully either today or tomorrow. But it's a great opportunity to talk to people, find out which way the wind's blowing. And we're at the start of a bid race for 2024, which is quite interesting for cities there. So that's what we're looking for at the moment.
Not nearly as explosive as this time last year when we were all reeling from an inflammatory speech from erstwhile Sport Accord president Marius Wiese. Obviously, the speech eventually led to his resignation. Sport Accord is a less powerful beast now. But as you say there, we are at the beginning of a summer Olympic bidding process. Paris, LA, Budapest and Rome, all with a significant presence here, I've noticed. I thought that was against IOC rules.
Well, what's happened is that each bid is limited to 10 delegates. But, I mean, all the cities have found a way around that. For example, Paris, they have their co-chairman, Bernard Lepasset and Tony Esquengay. They're here representing their respective sports, rugby and canoeing. Etienne Douar, who's the chief executive of Paris, is here representing badminton because he's on one of their commissions. So they all find a way around it. But what is different in this bid race to other bid races is that they're not allowed to do a presentation. So whereas before, the 2013 one, for example, all four cities did quite major presentations of up to an hour each. And I think that was the first time that people really thought that, Tokyo were edging ahead in that race. But we're being denied that opportunity here, which I think is a shame because, everybody that's involved in sport has an interest in who hosts the Olympics, the various stakeholders. They're here and it's a fantastic opportunity.
It's also a key opportunity here for the next Olympic host, Rio, in this instance, obviously coming up in 104 days' time, we're reminded today, to update absolutely everyone within the wider Olympic movement on just how the heck they're getting on. Obviously, they've come under a lot of pressure over the last few years, and increasingly so. The IOC said that there were thousands of issues still to be sorted out. Carlos Nussmann, the president of Rio 2016, spoke for all of 5 minutes, I think, in his update to ASWOF and various onlookers today. Were you in that, and what do you make of Rio's preparations to this point?
Well, I think Carlos Newsman has adopted very much a nothing to see here, move along approach. He's done that for a couple of years now. And I think it's wearing a bit thin, to be honest. People know there's issues there. There's no suggestion that Rio aren't going to stage the Games. I mean, what everybody wants here is for those issues to be solved so the Games are as good as they possibly can be in the circumstances. And I don't think his attitude really helps. I mean, last night there was problems overnight with the gymnastics test event that was mentioned today by Ron Follick, who's the International Gymnastics Federation representative here, because the president is actually at the event. You know, and the response he got was, "Well, you should have told us that yesterday." Quite how he was supposed to tell people about an event that happened overnight yesterday is a bit of a mystery. But I think, you know, the IOC and the Olympic movement are very much button down the hatches here and just hoping to get through it.
Mm-hmm. Also very present at Sport Accord, certainly in recent years, are those sports federations on the fringes of the Olympic movement, those sports who want to be included on the Olympic programme. And there are five currently, you know, the current state of play is that five have been recommended by Tokyo 2020 to the IOC. The IOC will have a sort of preliminary confirmation of those five in June, and assuming that they are all put through, there will be a vote during the IOC session at the Rio Games on whether those five sports or any one of those five sports will be included on the Tokyo 2020 programme. Seems to me, and I was with one of your colleagues actually earlier in a meeting with the chaps from the International Surfing Association, Fernando Aguirre, very visible presence here and on the Olympic movement circuit, I suppose, in his flamboyant bow ties. Seems to me that they're adopting quite a canny strategy for putting themselves forward to the IOC, trying to take advantage of Thomas Bach's predilection for getting in with the youth. Thomas Bach and his famous selfies. Fernando Aguirre was very careful to, at every opportunity, say how surfing wasn't a sport, it was a movement, it's a lifestyle, and it's a lifestyle aimed at young people. And that surfing wouldn't be just a sport that would happen, it would be a two-week-long Olympic festival on the beach, and that together with these other new sports, skateboarding, various other bits and pieces, you'd have an urban centre where there would be a festival, and then you'd have a beach centre where you would also have sort of music and yoga and this, that, and the other. Seems to me that that would be quite an appealing prospect for an Olympic president who wants to sort of redirect the Olympics more targeted towards young people. What's your feeling on those five sports, and do you think we can expect to see all of them lining up for Tokyo 2020?
Well, I think it's an interesting one, because I think part of this whole system of getting the new sports in was created partly to help baseball get into the games in Tokyo, because it's a national obsession for the Japanese. They were desperate for it to appear. So under Agenda 2020, which is the reason for so many things in the Olympics these days, you know, they created this system whereby you could add these extra sports at the request of the organising committee. So I don't think there's any doubt we'll see baseball there, and with baseball comes softball for gender equality, so I think they're fairly safe. I think some of the other ones are interesting. I mean, you could imagine surfing in perhaps LA 2024, that'd be fantastic. Less so in Tokyo. I think there's an issue with how they're going to stage the sport, where they're going to stage it. I mean, they do have technology now that they can create waves, but I mean, that obviously comes at a cost.
They've already said that they won't be using that technology. Wow. The IOC has ruled that out.
Yeah. Well, then you have the issue of where you're going to stage it, how you're going to stage it, how you're going to make it appealing to TV. I think sport climbing is a very interesting one. I know when they had it in the sports lab at the Summer Youth Olympic Games in Nanjing in 2014, it was a big hit. Karate, again, I think is partly there to appease the Japanese, you know, because it's so closely associated with that. And, of course, the one that the IOC really want in is skateboarding, you know, which is, they see as their way of getting down with the youth. Mm-hmm. But it's the one probably is the most danger of not appearing, simply because they don't have a recognised governing body. Mm-hmm. And you say, you know, that the sports are a presence here, but I bet you've not met anyone from skateboarding here yet.
Which I think is an indication, is it not, that skateboarding or skateboarders aren't particularly fussed about being in the Olympics?
Well, we're back to the situation before the 1998 Winter Olympics, which again was in Japan, in Nagano, when snowboarding was added to the Games. And again, they had no recognised governing body, so it was kind of shoved under the International Ski Federation. And at the time, the best snowboarder actually didn't even bother coming. And a very first gold medalist then tested positive for cannabis, you know, lost his gold medal. And I think you're right. I think the wider skateboarding community doesn't really see itself as a sport in the sense that we recognise in the Olympic Games. It sees itself, you know, as more as a pastime, a movement, a lifestyle thing.
A bit more anti-institution. The Olympics is the representation of the institution.
Yeah, exactly. I think they'll probably find some way of getting it in the Games, but I think it's going to be quite messy. Interestingly, the International Roller Sports Federation presented their case to Tokyo 2020, I think more in the hope that they would get roller skating in the Games on the back of it, and they haven't. And they're now kind of burdened with a sport they don't really have any history in. You have two rival skateboard federations. You have the International Skateboarding Federation and the World Skateboarding Federation. Both are professional organisations, money-making opportunities, who both want to run the sport. I think it's going to be a mess. It's going to dominate things for the next 3 or 4 years.
Talking of a mess, the final item of the agenda here at the Sport Accord Convention 2016 is the election of a new Sport Accord president. Patrick Bowman, the General Secretary of FIBA, the International Basketball Federation, reluctantly put himself forward after pressure from his colleagues, apparently. And after this announcement, I will explain more. Plaque VD327-937 est priée de la déplacer de l'entrée du Garden. Merci beaucoup. Merci beaucoup indeed. Patrick Bowman will be up against, now I can't pronounce her name, so you're going to have to do it for me.
Anna Azanova.
Anna Azanova, who is from the International
Underwater Sports Federation.
Of course, a very well-known figure around here. Two questions for you. Does it matter who is president of Sport Accord? And will Sport Accord continue? Well, is Sport Accord relevant to the wider Olympic movement, and will it maintain its relevance in the future?
I think the fact that there is so much lobbying for Patrick Bowman to take over, I think shows to me that it does matter to the Olympic movement and the wider the movement. The thing you have to remember is that there's 88 federations a member of Sport Accord. Only 29 of them are Olympic sports. So the non-Olympic sports, in theory, hold the majority and the power, which Marius Wiese utilised very well 3 years ago when he became president of Sport Accord. I think the ANA model is very closer to his model. She wants to organise, you know, events, make money for members, which I think is a threat to the IOC because they're so protective of the Olympic Games and its, you know, unique identity as a multi-sport event that they don't really want anybody coming in with those kind of ambitions. From what I hear, you know, Bowman is quite a way ahead in the polling. I think I'd be surprised if he didn't win. And the issue then is what he does with it. I mean, as you said, he's a reluctant candidate. He's got problems with his own federation at the moment, trying to keep control of various countries entering unsanctioned competitions. You know, he's threatened them with expulsion from Rio 2016. So I don't really think he's going to have much time to devote to Sport Accord. So I think what will happen if Bowman takes over, it will just be parked. And there is a danger it could slowly wither away over the years.
Which would be a shame, in my view. Anyway, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much, Duncan Mackay from Inside the Games. That was Duncan Mackay from Inside the Games. I am here with David Cushnan from Repicom and Patrick Nally from West Nally and the International Poker Federation of Poker. We're here at Sport Accord. We were about to be enjoying some beers, but they have stopped serving beers in anticipation of the opening ceremony. Chaps, it's always a good opportunity to spot sports politicians pounding the halls here at Sport Accord. Just today, I have seen, some very notable figures. Carlos Nussmann, Sebastian Coe, Luca de Montezemolo, previously of Ferrari, now of the Rome 2024 bid. David, you were talking earlier about having seen Marius Wiese. Notable, I think, in this particular Sport Accord are the delegations, as we heard from Duncan Mackay earlier, the delegations from the four bidding cities for the Summer Games in 2024. Duncan was explaining that they're getting around the rules, the Sport Accord and IOC rules of not being allowed to present here and only being allowed 10 members of a delegation by squeezing some people in round the sides and in kind of, right, they'll come with their International Sports Federation hat on rather than their bid hat on. David, you noted earlier that Casey Wasserman was here. This must be possibly his second sport accord.
I'm looking at him right now, just wondering, I think, towards the opening ceremony that we're all looking forward to here this evening. Yeah, interesting to see the big beasts, really, of this 2024 Olympic bidding cycle pacing the floors, as you said. And I was reading that the LA contingent have had already meetings with... formal meetings with all but one international sports federation on the Olympic program, and they'd had an informal meeting with the other. So they're clearly getting round, starting to make their case. Of course, at this point in what is still a very long race, we're well over a year away from finding out who it will be. They at least have now things like venue plans to talk through with federations and start to think about some of the challenges and some of the things that the federations will be requiring of them. But I do think it's turning into quite a fascinating race, just because you have Casey Wasserman heading up the LA bid, you have Bernard Lepasse, I think, about to, or has he already taken on his...
It's Bernard Lepasse and Tony Estrangé, their co-presidents or co-chairman of Paris 2024.
Yes, and as you said, Luca de Montezemolo heading up the Rome bid. And then you have Budapest, who, to be honest, I haven't seen.
Update on Budapest. Okay. They've just hired Lagardère Sports as a lead consultant, EKS specifically, which is a sort of subsidiary within Lagardère Sports. They are here today, the leadership team from Budapest 2024, but they have just left to go back to Budapest for an event in Budapest, and they'll be returning tomorrow evening, Wednesday evening, to press the flesh once more.
Okay, okay. A question for Patrick. You've worked with Luca de Montezemolo before?
I have indeed.
Back in the Italia 90 Absolutely. Days? So obviously he has gone on to have huge success as the president of Ferrari, and now I think he's the chairman of Alitalia, amongst other things, has flirted with Italian politics. Because we've heard a lot about the LA bid, we've heard a lot about the Paris bid. What does he bring to the party for Rome in terms of connections, skills, and just being really good at doing this sort of lobbying?
He's a very impressive man, because he's the only man in the world that I think could have possibly closed Fiumicino Airport, at least one of their runways, when we hosted the three tenors for the first time at the Caracalla in Italy in 1990. And when I told him that I needed to have an airport closed, instead of saying, I must be joking, he's one of those guys that said, no, I will solve you the problem. So, you know, he's a very able, very capable man. But unfortunately, I don't think he's going to be successful. I don't think Paris is going to be successful. I don't think Budapest is going to be successful. In terms of the current dramas that we see with the economic and the political problems in Rio, the fact that we've had Agenda 2020, the fact that we can't have further white elephants, I think that at the end of the day, LA is by far standing out as being, you know, the choice. You don't have to invest in stadia and facilities. They've got the financial support of the state. US has been refused too many times for it not to be a very serious problem if they refuse them this time, with NBC and the contracts that they have. That it's really nice to see that all the Olympic teams are now back at Sport Accord. They weren't here when Marius was running the show, but they're all here now. It's all in Lausanne. I'm no further comment. But my own instinct tells me that, you know, if the Olympics is going to respond to all of the political and economical dramas and security dramas that this world is facing, and they want the product to be true and strong, unfortunately, LA is just standing out as being the only choice. So poor old Montezemolo, I'm sure he will be wonderful, will be brilliant, but it's not just about closing the runway. It's shifting a big whole shift, which is going to be tough for Europe.
Well, I spoke to poor old Montezemolo earlier today. An interesting discussion, actually, and we'll hear it up next. He was talking about the key message that Rome 2024 seemed to be driving home now is the fact that it is an Olympics not just for Rome, but for the whole of Italy. Many of the delegation will talk about similar messages there. He also stressed the beauty of the country, the stories from the 1960 Games. Of course, it was the Games that Cassius Clay won his Olympic medal. Because he's Luca di Montezemolo and he's closely associated with Ferrari over many years, we also touched on Formula One, and he did not hold back there on the current his current views on Formula One. I also asked him about the differences between working with one sports political bigwig in Bernie Eccleston and another in Thomas Bach, and a president of the IOC. And what he had to say there was illuminating. So here's Luca di Montezemolo. Luca di Montezemolo, president, chairman of Rome's bid for the 2024 Olympics. What are you doing here at Sport Accord?
What do you do?
What are you doing here at Sport Accord today?
Yes. But this is, first of all, is my first presence here. I was quite curious to see this, how can I say, fair of sport. So I was curious. I was used to come very often to Lausanne because I've been for 25 years the chairman and CEO of Ferrari. Mm-hmm. And in Lausanne we have Philip Morris. We have, I remember in the past, with Mr. Samaranch for the Olympic Museum. But I'm also here because it's a good opportunity to meet a lot of members of IOC. It's good to see some colleagues and to take the opportunity to present our vision and our project. Mm-hmm.
As you say, you're 25 years running Ferrari, the motorsports arm of Ferrari as well. Everyone knows you from that. But before that, you ran Italia 90, the World Cup.
A fantastic experience and a fantastic remember. I've been very pleased of the success, despite Italy did not win, but this was not my key problem. And I think that I was also called to work for the organization of the U.S., because after Italian was U.S., but I didn't want to become a professional organizer. Mm-hmm. But my activity in the sport is old because I have organized the first Italian boat to the America's Cup Azzurra in the early 80s. I have organized the Italian 90, the World Cup. And of course, I've been always busy with Ferrari, with Formula One. Mm-hmm. So my life was really full based on sports, mm-hmm. different sports. But and now this adventure of Olympic is interesting because, you know, what I'm very pleased to see is that behind our activity, there is not only Rome, of course. Rome is really supporting us a lot, but there is the entire nations. I was last week with 4,000 in the south of Italy, in Crotone. Crotone was the town that was the Olympic Games before thousand and thousand years ago, close to Greece. And 4,000 young students to support the Olympic Games. There's nothing to do with Rome. Mm-hmm. We will do sailing in Sardinia. The entire island is really fully. I'm very confident, very pleased to see this Italian team spirit support from the President of the Republic, Prime Minister, the town of Rome, and the entire nation, because don't forget that we will do soccer matches in Torino, Milano, Verona, Bari, Bologna, Florence, Palermo. So the entire country will be really. And then we have two precedents. One is Rome 1960, big success, because if you remember, has been the first Olympic and was the first Paralympic games. The first was in Rome in the 60s. Then in Rome we put in front of the public heroes like Cassius Clay, mm-hmm. totally unknown at that time. He won the gold medal, this very strong, good-looking guy. Then Wilma Rudolph, mm-hmm. that won. Then Abele Bikila, that won the marathon. Then Torino, that was a good success also. At that time I was a Fiat chairman, so I was fully involved in the Olympic Games, of course, because Torino is the town of Fiat. And at that time I met a lot of IOC members in that occasion. So, good.
Rome is up against Paris, Hamburg, Paris, LA, Budapest. Yes. These races for the Olympic Games, in sports circles, they're always described as being very political. You have to, the voting members, IOC members, will vote for one of the cities next year and decide which one. You have to go about getting those votes. It's a political situation. Obviously, with your time and experience working for Ferrari and Formula One, also a very political environment. What do you think the differences are between this world of sport and that world of sport?
I agree with you when you use the word political, but what I mean for political is, first of all, I think that at the end of the day, the project will be crucial. I think that Rome is a magic town, is a town in which beauty, culture, history has to go together with sustainability, is one of the town in the world with most more green in South, sustainability, and second, innovation, because culture and beauty is fantastic, but we have to look ahead. So these are the key elements. And it's very important to have a project with very clear goals, with very clear idea what we do with the Venus after the Olympic Games. And this is something in which we are fully concentrated. So politically it means, yes, the choice is better to do the games in Europe or United States. It's better Rome or Paris or Budapest. Our activity is based on a very credible, on a very well done project. Mm-hmm. Then we will see. But I think, like in the business, I'm a businessman. I run companies like Fiat, like Ferrari. At the end of the day, the product is the most important element. You can do the best promotion, you can do the best advertising, you can have the best relations in the world, but the product is the same. What we are going to do is to put together Italy, the entire country, because from Rome you get by train 50 minutes to Florence, 50 minutes to Naples, so in one day you can go to visit Florence, visit Naples, Pompeii, is to have a good product. Then we will see.
Are you Roman?
No. Well, yes and no. I was born in Bologna. I spent a lot of my time in Bologna due to the Ferrari. But I've studied in Rome at Rome University. I took a degree in Rome University. Then I went to Columbia University in the United States. I live in Rome. My wife is from Rome. So at the end of the day, yes.
Who do you most enjoy working with? Thomas Bach or Bernie Eccleston?
They are two leaders. It's a good question. The first time, very different one from the other. Very different. I know very, very well Bernie, because don't forget that I was a team manager of Ferrari in the 70s with Enzo Ferrari. Yeah. So I met Bernie first time in 1973.
You were not even born.
Yes, he was the owner of Brabham. Yeah. Max Moser was March, Colin Chapman and Lotus. So yeah. I'm really know Formula One since a decade. Thomas, I knew him before my commitment for Rome. He's a very serious person. He's a person that I like him because he's able to handle a far more complicated and a worldwide organization. The difference between Eccleston and Thomas. Eccleston is fantastic one-man show. Thomas is a very good leader of an organization. This is a big difference. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I always think that you have to be able to manage your collaborators. So in terms of management, in terms of image, I feel me very more close to Bach than with Eccleston, despite I like it, because Eccleston is one-man show. Yeah, okay. It's unique.
And one word on Formula One, if I may. You say the product is the most important thing, talking about whatever you're doing, whether it's Rome 2024, Fiat, Ferrari, whatever you're doing, the product is key. What do you think about the Formula One product this year? Yeah. Are you still watching?
Yes, of course. I watch. I'm still, I don't want to look presumptuous to your eyes, but sometimes I think that as a team manager, as a chairman, I won 19 World Championship title between constructors and drivers, with Niki Lauda, with Michael Schumacher, with Kimi Raikkonen, different pilots. Formula One needs to look ahead. I think that we need to have a more clear separation of the rules. The teams has to do the teams without being involved in something. We need the governance with teams has to be teams. FIA has to be the referee to find out that nobody cheats. And we need a strong commercial owner, rights owner. I don't think that an investment fund can do this job, because we need somebody that will invest, look ahead. We need to have a five-year plans in which we identify clear goals, one between the others. Not the only one is United States. We need to have a strong presence over there with the program. Another one is the young people, social media, way to, and then we have to not to change the rules too often because the people get scared. So I think there is a lot of room to be improved, but it's very important to clarify the different rules, because I don't like overlapping the confusion. In this moment, I think there is a big confusion between who decide what.
Luca de Montezemolo, thank you very much.
Thank you. Nice meeting you.
That was Luca de Montezemolo, former president, former team. What was he, David?
He was all sorts. He was team manager originally and then came back and ended up as president of Ferrari for many years until the end of 2014.
And now he's president of the Rome 2024 Olympic bid. Another theme that always gets brought up at Sportacordon, for good reason, is the state of play in preparations for the next Olympics, possibly the next two Olympic Games. It's an opportunity, whilst members of federations of all sorts are here, for organising committees to update them on just what's going on. And obviously, Rio have been under the cosh for a few years now. Chaps, you've been here talking to people. Last couple of years, you know, there's been serious concerns about Rio's preparedness for this Games. Are you picking up on any particular alarm or dissatisfaction in general about what people think about Rio?
I think from my point of view, it's quite remarkable that suddenly Rio is being talked about in a more positive way than a negative way, that people are now becoming quite relaxed, that they do believe that venues will be there, that events will take place, that there will be the magic and the excitement of the Olympic Games. There may be transportation problems, there may be concerns about economics and political problems because of impeachment and all of those issues, but suddenly there seems to be, certainly the mood seems to be swinging, that actually the staging of the Games is in hand, that it will be a well-staged Games. And my own feeling is that despite all the dramas and the problems, that the magic of the Olympics will be seen to prove itself again.
Another interview that I did earlier, Patrick, you were earwigging this one, was with your old friend Brian Cookson, president of the International Cycling Union, and he did have some quite serious concerns about the preparations for the Rio Games. And this is Brian Cookson. Brian Cookson, president of the UCI, the International Cycling Union. We meet again at Sportacord. What are you doing here this time? You've just been in a closed meeting. I wasn't allowed access. None of the media were. What was on the agenda there?
Well, I've just been in a meeting of ASWAF, the Association of Summer Olympic Federations, with Thomas Bach and other IOC people, with an update on our annual meetings and discussions, and obviously the most pressing issues with us around Rio and longer-term Tokyo and Buenos Aires Youth Olympics and so on, and other issues of concern to international federations. So, yeah... as always with these kind of set piece things, the main business is done in a kind of reading between the lines kind of way, and outside of the formal forums, as it were. But it was worthwhile, and you know, as I say, you usually at these events they're all about networking, really, and the useful stuff is often done outside the meetings, in the corridors and in the bars, if I can put it that way, and you know, in the hotels and so on. And that's exactly what's happening here.
It's a while ago now, 3 years ago, but during your election campaign, one of the things that the incumbent at the time, Pat McQuaid, used as a stick to beat you with almost was your lack of familiarity with the Olympic movement in comparison to him. You've now been in post for coming up to 2.5 years. Do you feel a bit more embedded within this environment?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I was always pretty familiar with the Olympic movement. I was a member of the British Olympic Association's executive committee and management committee for many years. I'm an international commissaire of the UCI, so I was a member of the jury back in Barcelona in 92 at the Olympic Games there. So I've always been reasonably familiar with the Olympic movement politically. I've obviously spent the last 2.5 years putting myself around a little bit in Olympic circles and with other international federations, and built up some good relationships. So obviously I would like at some stage to be considered myself for IOC membership, and this is something that I'll be discussing with Thomas Bach, IOC president, in the next few weeks, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Well, fingers crossed for that. Obviously cycling a big part of the Olympics, one of the biggest sports on the Olympic program. From your perspective now, 104 days out from the start of the Rio Games, what are the preparations for the cycling events looking like? Are you pleased with where we are, or is there work still to do?
Well, I salute the massive efforts that have been made in difficult circumstances by Rio 2016 people. They are doing a great job in that sense. I do have some concerns. It's no secret that the velodrome is pretty much substantially delayed from what we'd hoped. I understand that the velodrome itself is, the track itself within the velodrome is completed, but the building itself still has to be finished off. I am concerned about climatic and humidity conditions in the building. We have to remember that the track is built from Siberian pine. Obviously, from when you take wood from the Arctic to somewhere like Rio, then there are issues of what the reaction of that timber is. So climate control, the humidity control is really, really important. And those are things which I've been assured by our friends in Rio they will look after very, very carefully. So there's that. There's the BMX and mountain bike facilities, which still need careful maintenance between now and the Games. And there's still some work to do on finalising some of the road surfaces and so on the road courses. But I'm very, very optimistic, and you know, there's no doubt that there's a real commitment from the Rio 2016 people, and I'm sure that we're going to see a fantastic set of events in our sport as in other sports in Rio.
You talk about safety and security. Recently, the UCI suspended the use of disc brakes, which I think was still on a probation period anyway. Probably a large result due to the feedback that Fran Ventoso gave the Movistar ride after being allegedly struck by one of these disc brakes in a fall. Nasty-looking crash recently. Fast, swift action from the UCI, I think, should be applauded. But, I mean, you did a lot of research going into using disc brakes in the peloton. Are you still hopeful that you'll be able to use them at some stage?
Well, I don't think we've seen the end of disc brakes by any means. What I think the manufacturers will do is look very carefully at the potential for injury from disc brakes. I think we will absolutely review the injuries that allegedly, as you say, have taken place. It's pretty inconclusive at the moment, actually, but even Fran Ventoso himself said that he couldn't say for sure that was what caused it, but you know, it there are different schools of thought on that. But if the possibility exists that this has caused this kind of injury, then we need to look at it carefully. I think, look, this trial is suspended. It's not finished. It's not ended. We will see. I'm sure the manufacturers come up with some appropriate response to this situation. And I think that that's right and proper. You know, and I've seen people compare the reaction on this with the reaction on the issues of motorcycles and cars causing problems or being involved in accidents and crashes in races and so on. And that is a more difficult thing to fix. And, you know, I make no apology for that. We have to be very careful about finding solutions that solve the problem, not that are knee-jerk reactions. In the case of the disc brakes, it's quite easy to say, well, you know, let's just suspend this for a time and do a bit more of a detailed investigation. Then we can reinstate the test as and when we think that's the right moment to do it. And we'll do that in consultation with the riders, with the teams, with the industry, as we have up to now.
Talking about cheating, motorised doping seems to be...
don't use that phrase. It's technological fraud. It's fraud. It's not doping. It's fraud. It's cheating by another method, but it's fraud. And almost calling it technological doping almost minimises it to me, but it's fraud. And we have spent a lot of time looking at this. There have been rumours for many years now, and over the last 2.5 years we've taken it even more seriously than was the case before. We've looked at methodologies, we've looked at invasive methods of you know, trying to find things, taking bikes apart and so on, but that's obviously very time consuming and so on. And we've spent a lot of time and a fair bit of money researching with a specialist developer some software and some gadgetry that we believe is very effective and allows a large number of bikes to be tested very, very quickly. So, you know, we don't need to take every bike apart to know that there is something suspicious there. The scanning will check that there is something there, and it will check for these, you know, high-tech super magnets in rear wheels and all these kind of other strange things that have that seem to be almost science fiction in some cases. And it is better than a heat camera, which I've seen suggested as well, because a heat camera will only detect a motor when it's operating, so by definition.
You really need a whistleblower in this scenario, I suppose. I mean, as you say, these rumours have been around for a long time, and they've been treated with varying degrees of respect, I suppose, but some of them seem more ludicrous than others. If someone came to you who had previously worked for a manufacturer or world tour team or something and said, I know for a fact that this is how you would do it if you were going to do it, has something like that happened? Do you have concrete...
Yeah, absolutely. We have been working with one of the manufacturers who is the licensee, who now has the license for manufacturing the motors that are in the seat tube and so on, and perhaps another series of methods. We've actually tested those bikes. I've ridden one of those bikes myself with a motor. It's incredibly effective, but it is quite easily detectable with the technology that we have now. What I find interesting now is that there are people speculating with all sorts of strange rumours and all sorts of technology that looks pretty unproven to me. And there is...
Are these the heat pictures we've seen recently?
You know, those I saw those heat pictures as the French journalist broadcast at the weekend, and... I found them pretty inconclusive, and when I sat with the guy, he said they were pretty inconclusive too. But then one reads a story where, you know, this is broadcast or promoted or reported in other journals as being proof of mechanical doping. You got me
fraud,
at it now,
fraud.
A technological fraud, but. But it isn't, and you know, there's a whole mixture of stuff. And what's incredible to me is that people will jump on a bandwagon and repeat things. On this is the power of the internet and Twitter and so on. People will repeat things as fact when they aren't fact. And And it's astonishing. And I saw on Twitter this afternoon someone saying, you know, isn't it amazing how the Twitter reaction has gone from, oh, this is all a load of nonsense, this isn't happening, what are UCI doing, wasting time and money on this, to why are the UCI not spending more and more time and effort on this? And
so you can't win all the time. Little point dealing in speculation, but rumours are something else. Two rumours on my radar at the moment. One of them less realistic than the other, I think. First of all, ASO is rumoured to be preparing to launch its own world tour next year. I guess that's come out of them not being totally on board with the proposals that the UCI has on the table. Second rumour, Wang Jianlin, one of the richest men in China, the new owner of Infront Sports and Media, the agency, Atletico Madrid, World Triathlon Corporation. He wants to buy ASO and RCS and be the new kingpin in cycling. Both of them rumours, it must be stressed, although I have it on good authority that Wang Jianlin has made concrete bids for both of those organisations. Are you prepared for either one of those scenarios?
Well, you know, there are some things that I can control and some things that I can't control. And, ASO, I think it would be a mistake for the sport if they decided to take all of their events outside of UCI. I think actually that will be quite difficult for them, except maybe for their events in France. They want to do events in many countries. Their business model, I would suggest, depends upon expansion into other countries, other territories. And those territories have national federations that are affiliated to the UCI, and they will want to be part of the UCI structure. So I think it will be a mistake for them. And, I want to try and avoid that if I can. But, you know, I don't want to damage their business, and I don't think anything that we're proposing would do. So I want to keep sitting down with them and keep talking and find a solution that avoids that doomsday scenario, as it were. In terms of Wanda and Mr. Wang Jianlin, I've met him. I know that he's got aspirations to have an involvement in our sport. He already owns Infront Thuringier and the Tour de Suisse and so on. I'm sure he'd like to do events in China, and I'm sure that he would like to expand his portfolio. Whether ASO or RCS or any other organiser is for sale is a matter for them, not for me.
Brian Cookson, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome.
That was Brian Cookson, president of the International Cycling Union. David Cushman and Patrick Nally with me here at Sport Accord. Chaps, I'm afraid the opening ceremony is about to begin. My battery is about to run out, and the storage on my phone is also about to go. So it's an absolute hat trick. Let's draw a line under it there. Patrick Nally, thank you very much.
My pleasure. See you again.
David Cushman, thank you also to you.
Thank you. Happy Sport Accord opening ceremony.